Chapter 16. The two men looked in the faces of the two dogs. The two dogs looked, with at least equal intelligence, in the faces of the two men. O seekers, then! Help! To the rescue! Cried the two men. The two dogs, with a glad, deep, generous bark, bounded away. Two more mad ones! Said the men, stricken motionless, and looking away in the moonlight. Is it possible in such weather? And one of them a woman. Each of the dogs had the corner of a woman's dress in its mouth, and drew her along. She fondled their heads as she came up, and she came up through the snow with an accustomed tread. Not so the large man with her, who was spent and winded. Dear guides, dear friends of travelers, I am of your country. We seek two gentlemen crossing the pass, who should have reached the hospice this evening. They have reached it, mademoiselle. Thank heaven! Oh, thank heaven! But, unhappily, they have gone on again. We are setting forth to seek them even now. We had to wait until the tournament passed. It has been fearful up here. Dear guides, dear friends of travelers, let me go with you. Let me go with you for the love of God. One of those gentlemen is to be my husband. I love him, oh, so dearly. Oh, so dearly. You see I am not faint, you see I am not tired. I am born a peasant girl. I will show you, that I know well, how to fasten myself to your ropes. I will do it with my own hands. I will swear to be brave and good. But let me go with you, let me go with you. If any mischance should have befallen him, my love would find him, when nothing else could. On my knees, dear friends of travelers. By the love your dear mothers had for your fathers. The good rough fellows were moved. After all, they murmured to one another, she speaks but the truth. She knows the ways of the mountains. See how marvelously she has come here. But as to monsieur there, mademoiselle? Dear Mr. Joey, said Marguerite, addressing him in his own tongue, you will remain at the house, and wait for me, will you not? If I know it which of you two recommended it, growled Joey Ladle, eyeing the two men with great indignation, I'd fight you for sixpence, and give you half a crown towards your expenses. No, miss. I'll stick by you, as long as there's any sticking left in me, and I'll die for you, when I can't do better. The state of the moon rendering it highly important, that no time should be lost, and the dogs showing signs of great uneasiness, the two men quickly took their resolution. The rope that yoked them together was exchanged for a longer one. The party were secured, Marguerite second, and the cellarman last, and they set out for the refuges. The actual distance of those places was nothing. The whole five, and the next hospice to boot, being within 2 miles, but the ghastly way was whitened out and sheeted over. They made no miss in reaching the gallery, where the two had taken shelter. The second storm of wind and snow had so wildly swept over it since, that their tracks were gone. But the dogs went to and fro with their noses down, and were confident. The party stopping, however, at the further arch, where the second storm had been especially furious, and where the drift was deep, the dogs became troubled, and went about and about, in quest of a lost purpose. The great abyss being known to lie on the right, they wandered too much to the left, and had to regain the way with infinite labor through a deep field of snow. The leader of the line had stopped it, and was taking note of the landmarks, when one of the dogs fell to tearing up the snow a little before them. Advancing and stooping to look at it, thinking that someone might be overwhelmed there, they saw that it was stained, and that the stain was red. The other dog was now seen to look over the brink of the gulf, with his four legs straightened out, lest he should fall into it, and to tremble in every limb. Then the dog who had found the stained snow joined him, and then they ran to and fro, distressed and whining. Finally, they both stopped on the brink together, and setting up their heads, howled dolefully. There is someone lying below, said Marguerite. I think so, said the foremost man. Stand well inward, the two last, and let us look over. The last man kindled two torches from his basket and handed them forward. The leader taking one, and Marguerite the other, they looked down, now shading the torches, now moving them to the right or left, now raising them, now depressing them, as moonlight far below contended with black shadows. A piercing cry from Marguerite broke a long silence. My God! On a projecting point, where a wall of ice stretches forward over the torrent, I see a human form. Where, mademoiselle, where? See, there. On the shelf of ice below the dogs. The leader, with a sickened aspect, drew inward, and they were all silent. But they were not all inactive, for Marguerite, with swift and skillful fingers, had detached both herself and him from the rope in a few seconds. Show me the baskets. These two are the only ropes? The only ropes here, mademoiselle. But at the hospice, if he is alive, I know it is my lover. He will be dead before you can return. Dear guides, blessed friends of travelers, look at me. Watch my hands. If they falter or go wrong, make me your prisoner by force. If they are steady and go right, help me to save him. She girded herself with a cord under the breast and arms, she formed it into a kind of jacket, she drew it in two knots, she laid its end side by side with the end of the other cord, she twisted and twined the two together, she knotted them together, she set her foot upon the knots, she strained them, she held them for the two men to strain at. She is inspired, they said to one another. By the Almighty's mercy, she exclaimed. You both know that I am by far the lightest here. Give me the brandy and the wine, and lower me down to him. Then go for assistance and a stronger rope. You see that when it is lowered to me, look at this about me, now I can make it fast and safe to his body. Alive or dead, I will bring him up, or die with him. I love him passionately. Can I say more? They turned to her companion, but he was lying senseless on the snow. Lower me down to him, she said, taking two little kegs they had brought, and hanging them about her, or I will dash myself to pieces. I am a peasant, and I know no giddiness or fear, and this is nothing to me, and I passionately love him. Lower me down. Mademoiselle, mademoiselle, he must be dying or dead. Dying or dead, my husband's head shall lie upon my breast, or I will dash myself to pieces. They yielded, overborne. With such precautions as their skill and the circumstances admitted, they let her slip from the summit, guiding herself down the precipitous icy wall with her hand, and they lowered down, and lowered down, and lowered down, until the cry came up. Enough! Is it really he, and is he dead? They called down, looking over. The cry came up. He is insensible, but his heart beats. It beats against mine. How does he lie? The cry came up. Upon a ledge of ice. It has thawed beneath him, and it will thaw beneath me. Hasten. If we die, I am content. One of the two men hurried off with the dogs at such topmost speed as he could make. The other set up the lighted torches in the snow, and applied himself to recovering the Englishman. Much snow chafing, and some brandy got him on his legs, but delirious and quite unconscious where he was. The watch remained upon the brink, and his cry went down continually. Courage! They will soon be here. How goes it? And the cry came up. His heart still beats against mine. I warm him in my arms. I have cast off the rope, for the ice melts under us, and the rope would separate me from him. But I am not afraid. The moon went down behind the mountain tops, and all the abyss lay in darkness. The cry went down. How goes it? The cry came up. We are sinking lower, but his heart still beats against mine. At length the eager barking of the dogs, and a flare of light upon the snow, proclaimed that help was coming on. 20 or 30 men, lamps, torches, litters, ropes, blankets, wood to kindle a great fire, restoratives and stimulants, came in fast. The dogs ran from one man to another, and from this thing to that, and ran to the edge of the abyss, dumbly entreating speed, speed, speed. The cry went down. Thanks to God, all is ready. How goes it? The cry came up. We are sinking still, and we are deadly cold. His heart no longer beats against mine. Let no one come down, to add to our weight. Lower the rope only. The fire was kindled high, a great glare of torches lighted the sides of the precipice, lamps were lowered, a strong rope was lowered. She could be seen passing it round him, and making it secure. The cry came up into a deathly silence. Raise! Softly! They could see her diminished figure shrink, as he was swung into the air. They gave no shout, when some of them laid him on a litter, and others lowered another strong rope. The cry again came up into a deathly silence. Raise! Softly! But when they caught her at the brink, then they shouted, then they wept, then they gave thanks to heaven, then they kissed her feet, then they kissed her dress, then the dogs caressed her, licked her icy hands, and with their honest faces warmed her frozen bosom. She broke from them all, and sank over him on his litter, with both her loving hands upon the heart that stood still. Act 4. The clock lock. The pleasant scene was nuptial. The pleasant month was April. The pleasant place was a notary's office. The pleasant person in it was the notary. A rosy, hearty, handsome old man, chief notary of nuptial, known far and wide in the canton as Mater Voigt. Professionally and personally, the notary was a popular citizen. His innumerable kindnesses and his innumerable oddities had for years made him one of the recognized public characters of the pleasant Swiss town. His long brown frock coat and his black skull cap were among the institutions of the place. And he carried a snuff box which, in point of size, was popularly believed to be without a parallel in Europe. There was another person in the notary's office, not so pleasant as the notary. This was a Benriezer. An oddly pastoral kind of office it was, and one that would never have answered in England. It stood in a neat backyard, fenced off from a pretty flower garden. Goats browsed in the doorway, and a cow was within half a dozen feet of keeping company with the clerk. Mater Voigt's room was a bright and varnished little room, with paneled walls, like a toy chamber. According to the seasons of the year, roses, sunflowers, hollyhocks, peeped in at the windows. Mater Voigt's bees hummed through the office all the summer, in at this window, and out at that, taking it frequently in their day's work, as if honey were to be made from Mater Voigt's sweet disposition. A large musical box on the chimney piece often trilled away at the overture to Fra Diavolo, or a selection from William Tell, with a chirruping liveliness that had to be stopped by force on the entrance of a client, and irrepressibly broke out again the moment his back was turned. "Courage, courage, my good fellow," said Mater Voigt, patting a Benriezer on the knee, in a fatherly and comforting way. "You will begin a new life, tomorrow morning in my office here." A Benriezer dressed in mourning, and subdued in manner lifted his hand, with a white handkerchief in it, to the region of his heart. "The gratitude is here," he said. "But the words to express it are not here." "Ta ta ta! Don't talk to me about gratitude," said Mater Voigt. "I hate to see a man oppressed. I see you oppressed, and I hold out my hand to you by instinct. Besides, I am not too old yet to remember my young days. Your father sent me my first client. It was on a question of half an acre of vineyard that seldom bore any grapes. Do I owe nothing to your father's son? I owe him a debt of friendly obligation, and I pay it to you. That's rather neatly expressed, I think," added Mater Voigt, in high good humor with himself. "Permit me to reward my own merit with a pinch of snuff." A Benriezer dropped his eyes to the ground, as though he were not even worthy to see the notary take snuff. "Do me one last favor, sir," he said, when he raised his eyes. "Do not act on impulse. Thus far, you have only a general knowledge of my position. Hear the case for and against me, in its details, before you take me into your office. Let my claim on your benevolence be recognized by your sound reason as well as by your excellent heart. In that case, I may hold up my head against the bitterest of my enemies, and build myself a new reputation on the ruins of the character I have lost. As you will, said Mater Voigt. You speak well, my son. You will be a fine lawyer one of these days. The details are not many, pursued Abenreezer. My troubles begin with the accidental death of my late traveling companion, my lost dear friend Mr. Vendale. Mr. Vendale, repeated the notary. Just so. I have heard, and read of the name, several times within these 2 months. The name of the unfortunate English gentleman who was killed on the Simplon. When you got that scar upon your cheek and neck. From my own knife, said Abenreezer, touching what must have been an ugly gash at the time of its infliction. From your own knife, assented the notary, and in trying to save him. Good, good, good. That was very good. Vendale. Yes. I have several times, lately, thought it droll, that I should once have had a client of that name. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.